Welcome to The Mockingcast, the podcast of Mockingbird Ministries. I'm David Zoll, your host, and in a few moments, I'll be joined by my co-hosts, Sarah Condon and RJ Heyman. We come to you every other week to discuss a few of the places where we currently see grace and its absence playing out in unexpected and compelling ways. We're glad to have you with us.
Praise the Lord.
Good morning. It is 1 week closer to the resurrection. As Sarah always says, the goalposts are moving, but they're moving toward us. And for people who work in churches, they're moving sort of rapidly towards us. In not always the most hopeful way. Sometimes it feels overwhelming, I'm sure. How are the two of you guys doing? Is that a big factor for you right now? Or is it more just, are you like me and just sort of living for children's extracurriculars, which seem to dominate almost half
every
of your
waking
hours?
Every waking hour of your life. I mean, it's Josh's first Easter here at St. B's. So we're excited to see what, you know, Holy Week looks like. And but it is hard because we just came off spring break and now we're like, you know, in it. So, I mean, I'm excited, but also like I can always be excited because I'm not the person running the show. So
yeah,
it's like a little easier for me to be like, oh, you know.
And it's like going to a sleepover at your friend's house. Like every church does Easter a little differently. Like
100%.
every family does breakfast a little bit differently.
Yeah.
Even if you're all eating eggs.
Yeah, totally.
I'll be very interested to hear how it goes.
We are on spring break this week, or at least my youngest son is. And our kids have different spring breaks, which is kind of a bummer. And so, but it worked out. Our middle son came home for a few days last week, which is really fun. Our oldest son comes home tonight for a few days, which will be really fun. So kind of getting a little spring break, but also kind of working at the same time because Holy Week is next week and then Easter. But I'm looking forward to it. You know, every time I get a little stressed out, but then things seem to work out. Things can work out, so I'm feeling pretty relaxed about it, actually, and excited.
Are you going to get time off after Easter?
Couple days, yeah. I think the office is closed like Monday, Tuesday, but we have a busy season. We got some things cooking this spring.
Good.
Well, I know one thing you have cooking is you'll be in New York with Sarah and I.
I will. Can't wait.
Once again, invite everyone to the Mockingbird Conference in New York. That's April 25th through the 27th. There's still some space, but not that much. And we got some very exciting word that through RJ that we're going to have to get to do a little pre-conference tour of some James Tissot paintings, which we've talked about on here, the wonderful Impressionist. So if you're interested in that, there's space for that. It's very limited. It's only open to conference goers, but email us at info@ember.com. immediately.
Yes.
Very cool.
But behind the scenes viewing at the Brooklyn Museum. They're not on view, but they're going to open it up and show us the paintings we want to see, which I'm actually super excited about.
That's so cool.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah. I mean,
when you ride the RJ Heyman gravy train, take you anywhere. It really is.
You never know.
But honestly, if the folks are interested, this is a once in a lifetime opportunity. It's unbelievably world class, but we probably won't have any space for you, but try. Please email us. We'd love for you to join us. Someone sent me an amazing little Instagram story of an octopus named Otto in Germany who has caused an aquarium power outage by climbing to the edge of his tank and shooting a jet of water at a bright light that was annoying him.
Yes, Otto.
Nice.
He's also been seen juggling hermit crabs, throwing rocks at the glass, and rearranging his tank surroundings. Nowadays, the people of Coburg, where he's housed, are coming up with new ways to keep Otto occupied, like giving him a chessboard. He always adapts to his surroundings, but as soon as the chessboard is in there, it's just black, white, black, white. So that keeps him entertained for quite a while. But one time, he just didn't want the chessboard, and he just threw it out of the aquarium. I love this Otto, the octopus, but what is fascinating here is that he clearly is not just mischievous, but very playful, which leads us to our first article this week is Do Animals Have Fun? It's by Sally Tisdale in The Atlantic. She writes, this animal play has come into focus as a subject of study only in the past century. The field is still developing even basic principles. What is play? How do we define it in species as different from us and from each other as octopuses and crows? In humans, many forms of play imitate serious behavior: hunting, courtship, exploration, building, fighting. We recognize play in other species if it looks like our own games. Well, in a new book called The Kingdom of Play, David Toomey finds a definition by ethologist Gordon Burghardt particularly helpful. Play is behavior that is non-functional, voluntary, characterized by repeated but varied movements, and occurring only when the animal is healthy, safe, and well-fed. Research suggests that human children deprived of play can develop serious difficulties. Play promotes physical strength and group bonding, teaches social skills, and relieves stress. Therefore, in the scientific view, play is an adaptation. They are prone to consider play as a neurological drive, scientists are, an instinct or a social response. But many animals also engage in behaviors with no obvious benefit. Piglets often run around and occasionally perform a kind of flip. Researchers have been inclined to see this as skill building. Toomey writes, the piglet undertakes the flopover not for its own sake, but in anticipation of the moment immediately after the flopover when it recovers and regains control. Bemused, he adds that most observers recognize that a somersault appears thrilling to piglets and that falling down seems to be the point. Toomey offers other examples of animal behavior that appear to be non-functional, as many people have reported watching elephants slide down muddy embankments, appearing to deliberately collide with other elephants climbing up. They do it again and again and again. Songbirds sometimes sing when they are alone, repeating a phrase or trill several times. They seem to be singing simply for the sake of it. Tisdale writes, these theorists can be a bit dispiriting. Sometimes I want to whack one on the side of the head and say, hey, catch this ball. Of course, the real question isn't whether animals play, but how to understand what is happening when they do. If we can conceive that possibly an animal is simply having fun, that somersaulting may be good training for the unexpected, but one wonders, why is it so hard to believe that exuberance is in itself a good? Now, I thought this was amazing. Just it highlights, she seems to be very frustrated with the fact that this writer cannot conceive of animals just wanting to have fun, a piglet just falling down over and over again just because they're enjoying it, that it has to be somehow serving a greater purpose. It has to be a means to another end rather than simply play. And Otto the Octopus shows that elephant sliding into one another like in a Disney movie. Besides that, but I mean, you guys have dogs, you used to have pets. Play, do you see them playing? Do they play with you, or are they just simply machines?
I was actually thinking about spring break because we went to see my cousin and her family, and we brought our dogs, and we have two dogs, and they have two dogs. And it's like, we're like evenings, we're like sitting in the kitchen together, like, you know, talking about our childhoods, drinking Chardonnay, you know, probably like wallowing in misery more than we should. And the dogs are just having a blast, you know, like, and I just kept looking at the dogs and being like, how do we do that? That looks like more fun. You know, like it just, there's something also like for me inherently, I don't know if I should say specifically Christian, but definitely of God, like the concept of like joy for joy's sake, or maybe even needless joy, right? Like unnecessary joy. Like, I think when we look at, you know, the history of biology and sort of the need for, you know, for life to persist and to evolve and all these sort of like really heady scientific things that we know, you know, the thing that we can't really explain in a lot of ways is joy.
Yeah.
So it feels very of God to me in a really beautiful way. That's joy necessary for survival. Maybe that is where it sort of crosses into the biological. But anyway, it's just interesting.
But it does in some ways point to, you know, the nature of, you know, when we Christians talk about a creator.
Yeah.
The creator is good. Joy seems to be built into the equation somehow.
Yeah.
And it is amusing to watch some of the scientists sort of rationalize.
Right. You know,
a mudslide.
Right. An elephant mudslide.
What are you thinking?
I'd be surprised if this wasn't mentioned in the article because I didn't read the whole thing. But it made me immediately think of the killer whales off the coast of Spain recently, uh-huh, that have been like playing with sailboats and then often like breaking rudders off the back of sailboats, like attacking sailboats. And killer whales have I think there's maybe one instance where there was a killer whale in captivity that like wasn't doing very well that maybe inadvertently injured a person.
Yeah.
But in general, they're not violent towards people at all.
Yeah.
But everyone had these theories like, why are the killer whales mad at us? Is this because of global warming? Are they trying to get back at us? Were there naval exercises, you know, in the Atlantic that's like set them off? And then these biologists were like, you know, actually, we think that maybe killer whales actually have fads the way that human beings do, that it seems to be a bit of a fad. Like apparently there was another fad that went around for a few years in the killer whale world where they would wear dead salmon as hats.
Yes,
they
honey.
Would catch a salmon, put it on their head, and then just swim around with a dead fish on their head. And all the killer whales were doing it.
They stopped doing it.
And then they just stopped doing it, you know? So yep. I guess what's interesting from my perspective is the degree to which we anthropomorphize animals. And we always have, you know, very buzzkill scientists being like, don't do that. They're not people. You know, you can't project your own stuff onto them. But of course, we're always projecting our own stuff onto them. Yeah. And if they're creatures and we're creatures, then maybe anthropomorphizing isn't the worst thing in the world. Like having a little bit of empathy. And also, as you guys have already said, this drive to make everything utilitarian.
Yeah.
You know, they're like, we play so that we can work. We rest so that we can work. We have fun so that we can be better at our job.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, where's the space for just doing something that's just fun for its own sake? But I'll also say in my own life, I don't know. It doesn't feel like there's a lot of space for just pure fun. And I wish there was, but that's also probably the gift of children a little bit, you know, that they draw you into things that are not functional. That are
all
just
the time.
Even if they're, I mean, all Marshall wants to do
gymnastics.
Right now.
Gymnastics.
Oh my gosh.
Hey, youth group, guys. Remember we talked about it a
that's
few episodes
right.
ago.
All Marshall wants to do right now is play pickleball in our yard for like 2 hours every night, and he is wearing us out.
Oh my god.
But it is fun. But I'm just like, I'm almost 50. Jamie woke up yesterday morning. She's like, I am so sore.
From pickleball.
From pickleball. I'm going to rupture Achilles sooner rather than later. And he's relentless, relentless. So anyway.
But pickleball's fun.
Those are my
and
thoughts.
And so is, they do
that.
Mention those orcas, those killer whales, like, and how the scientists basically concluded, we think that possibly they're just showing off. Like,
yeah.
I concur wholeheartedly with this sort of cult of productivity. And, you know, the only way to sell Americans on sleep is to tell them they'll be able to work better. And that really is true. And to regain fun as an end in itself. And people, things are only actually truly fun if they are an end in themselves or if you think they're an end in themselves, you know?
Yeah.
My son is about to start flag football. And one of the reasons we like flag football is because there is no collegiate flag football programs and there are no high school flag football programs. And they just, it's basically recess that is kind of given a pass because it's slightly organized. And unlike baseball, unlike basketball, flag football has no future. So it's simply fun. And like, I think there's something totally gracious.
He's not
going to
get a scholarship.
No one's getting a scholarship in flag football.
Not putting that on the college resume.
Yeah.
No.
You know the gift of that, though, that is future Ford, is he will be able to like rally a group of people together to play flag football when everyone's lonely in their apartments at like 25. Do you know what I mean? Like there is that is like a beautiful future Ford gift. It's just not one that we view as like.
Yeah, Spencer was the quarterback of his flag football team at Rice and he just like loved it.
Yeah.
You know, like it was the best. Yeah.
So more sports that cannot get you a scholarship or improve your resume at all, I'm in favor of. So
yes.
And possibly pickleball was that for a while, and now it looks like there's plenty of
it's on ESPN. Going on. It's ridiculous.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Well, play, though play is a key category for grace, and it's one of this new book I'm writing, it's one of the, I think play is really, it is sort of, it is the relief from work. you know, that's, and it's grace in that respect. The gospel, RJ, you're the one who said it a few episodes ago, but like the gospel takes away the stakes. You're playing with house money. There's freedom to play and to be interested in things for their own sake. It doesn't always have to be pickleball or flag football. It can simply be mahjong, or it can be a reading. I mean, anything like that.
And can I also say, in my better moments, this is not always the case, but in my better moments, you know, work starts to feel a little bit like play, hopefully, where it's let's try this. Yeah. Maybe it'll work. Maybe it won't.
Yeah.
It might be fun. We might learn something. We might fall on our faces. Who cares?
Right.
you know, like not seeing everything as just so dangerous or risky or you know, fraught.
Yeah.
You know, and it might be a bit of a risk, but like, hey, Jesus is going to be there on the other side no matter what.
Yeah.
You know?
On my best days, that's certainly how I like to approach Mockingbird, you know?
Don't you know that because you've experienced failure in church? Like, not to be too pointed about it, but because you had a church plant and it didn't, you know, succeed
I
later?
I don't know, Sarah. Like, I would say, I don't know. That's a really good question. I think, if anything, some of my professional failure makes me a little bit gun shy because, as you know, like in this line of work, when you fail, it means like moving hundreds of miles away and completely restarting your life.
Yeah.
You know, putting your kids in new schools, finding new doctors, buying a new house. It's like, it feels pretty weighty. Can I say this?
Sure.
The pandemic, for all the things that were so awful about it, created this space of freedom because, like, just to do anything was a win.
Yeah.
You know, Jamie and I have been watching, you haven't watched this, but you got to watch this. Full Swing, the golf documentary on Netflix, is maybe the best sports documentary I've ever seen because they get these guys to actually talk about their real lives, their struggles. They talk to their therapists. Like, it's amazing. And one of the characters in the recent season is the younger brother of a really, really good golfer and has always been not as good as his brother and trying to get on the tour. But then he came into his first British Open, which is one of the four big tournaments, and he talked about the freedom of playing when there's no expectation, when like everything is a win, when there's no fear of failure. And I do think in ministry, the pandemic brought a little bit of that because it was like, well, we can't do church the way we've ever done it before. Let's just try it. Let's just throw some things up on the wall and see what sticks.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a really hard time, but it was also kind of a playful time in a way because there was no other option.
Yeah,
right?
I agree with that. It was playful until it turned really dark. But I do recall that, and all these competitions being ceased. There was something deeply relieving about that. Well, let's talk about something else that's sort of slightly useless, but on a more, you know, kind of a semi-darker, but also kind of entertaining side of things. This is from Jacob Stern in The Atlantic. Of course, America fell for liquid death. He begins by this. The business of bottled water is pretty odd. What other industry produces billions in revenue selling something that almost everyone in America can get basically for free? Almost every brand claims in one way or another to be the purest or best tasting or most luxurious, but very little distinguishes Poland Spring from Aquafina or Dasani or Evian. And then there is Liquid Death. You know, people haven't seen it. It's a new bottled water brand. The company sells its water in tall boy cans branded with its over-the-top name, more over-the-top melting skull logo, and even more over-the-top slogan, Murder Your Thirst. After the great success of its plain canned water, it has branched out into iced tea and seltzer with flavors such as Mango Chainsaw, Bury It Alive, and Dead Billionaire. Well, on Monday, Bloomberg reported that the company is now valued at $1.4 billion, double the valuation it received in late 2022. That would make it more than one-tenth the size of the entire no and low alcohol beverage industry. Liquid Death is not a water company so much as a brand that happens to sell water. To the extent that the company is selling anything, it's selling metal in both senses of the word. It's literal aluminum cans, which it frames as part of its environmentally motivated Death to Plastic campaign, and it's heavy metal punk rock style. Now, idiosyncratic as all this might seem, the company's strategy is not a departure from modern branding. If anything, it is its perfect distillation. I wonder if that was meant to be a pun. The brand is what's important. The brand is all there is. Liquid Death's CEO, Mike Cesario, likes to say that Liquid Death is by no means unique in its focus on marketing. Last year, he told the Washington Post, like every truly large, valuable brand, it is all marketing and brand because the reason people choose things 98% of the time is not rational. It's emotional. Well, no wonder then so many companies have begun deploying meta advertisements, advertisements that are about advertisements or refer explicitly to the fact that they're advertisements. Think of CeraVe's Super Bowl commercial in which Michael Cera pitches an ad featuring him as his awkward, creepy best to a boardroom full of horrified executives, or the State Farm commercial that also aired during the Super Bowl in which Arnold Schwarzenegger struggles to enunciate the word neighbor, while playing Agent State Farm in an ad within the ad.
Yeah.
These ads wink at the viewer. They say, we know that you know what we're trying to do here, so we're just going to cut the crap and be straight with you. The marketing strategy is to renounce marketing strategies. You can think of Liquid Death as the apotheosis of...
Apotheosis?
Girl, I don't know what that word means. Come on now, dictionary. Come on. Come on, East Coast. What does that mean?
Come on, Georgetown. Come on, Hoya. Couldn't make the tournament, can't say the word. Okay.
You can think of Liquid Death as the apotheosis of meta advertising. It doesn't just say forget the product for a moment while you watch this ad. It dispenses with the product entirely. The advertisement is the product. What Liquid Death is selling is not so much purified water as purified marketing. You guys like that Liquid Death stuff?
I mean, no.
It's so dumb.
I don't want to carry that around.
I saw it for the first time at Austin City Limits like 2.5 years ago, and I was like, that's the dumbest thing I've ever seen in my life.
I don't think it's meant for me. It's so disappointing because, like, when the first time I saw it, I was like, what is Liquid Death? Like, I love death. And, like, I went over and I was like,
liquid warm. Yes, please.
Are you kidding me? This is just water?
Like, that's it. It's just water. No. It doesn't sound that good.
My kids love it. That's for sure.
Do they really?
Yeah, they do.
Do they love it more than they love, Prime? What do they prefer, Prime or Liquid Death?
Are we talking Prime too?
Prime is the worst thing in the... I had one sip. I was like, this is the sweetest thing I've ever... Yeah. I don't know
most
how anyone
disgusting
can finish.
Of all.
It's disgusting. Yeah. Talk about all marketing. That guy is a genius.
Well, the Easter Bunny's bringing Prime this year, so that's how important Prime is in our house.
I mean, Prime is the first time I feel like I was completely taken for a ride by middle schoolers. You know, like
Logan
ad
Paul
campaign that was like not aimed at me even remotely. I never even heard of it. And then they're on YouTube. And you know, this is a very fascinating thing.
Do you see he's fighting Mike Tyson, by the way?
Logan Paul?
Yes. He's fighting Mike Tyson on Netflix.
Will wonders never cease?
It's crazy.
All for the brand.
It is. It's all in this realm. This is all. That guy's he's a genius.
It was funny. This
and also terrifying.
We have a confirmation class going on at our church right now, and we just did a class about the church and about the Church Universal and the Episcopal Church and Christ Church. And Paul Walker, you know, who was teaching the class, said, "You know, I just want to be very careful to say the church is important, but I'm not here to be a brand ambassador for the church of any denomination, including the big C, little C, because we do think of churches have gotten into the branding game. They've sort of, some would say, they've always 100%. Been into the branding game.
Yeah.
Someone wanted to show me how our diocese, which is the Episcopal Church word for sort of regions, had decided to rebrand, and that was seen as the right, you know, change of the logo, and that was seen as the
Episcopal Church in Connecticut.
Well, given
that's all I can think about, baby. Yeah, the Episcopal Church in Connecticut is all. Yeah.
I'm not going to get in trouble for this because I'm not, you know, on the rolls, but I don't think branding is the main issue facing the church.
Are you sure? Really?
I know. Could it go way out on a limb here and say that I'm not sure? I kind of like the old Episcopal logo.
You want to talk about Liquid Death? We've got liquid. It's red.
Oh my god!
Boom!
That's how I'm going to change. Liquid Death, West Palm Beach. Here we go. That's right. Oh, my gosh. This might come up in my Good Friday sermon. We'll see.
Mockingbird has to come. We have to do branding all the time.
Totally.
It's a thing.
We don't do enough of it.
Let me say, there is something. It is important. I do think it's important that your church looks a little bit like someone gives a shit. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah.
Okay? So,
yeah.
You heard it here first.
Yeah.
No, I'm serious. I'm serious. Yeah. Like, there's branding, okay. But also, like, cut the lawn, have the paint look decent, have okay bat, like someone cares, you know?
Someone cares.
Just because you're anti-branding doesn't mean that your church needs to be a dump.
Yeah.
You know?
That's what we're dealing with. I think you go into other forms of the church, and I remember going to being invited to a conference in a very different denominational setting and thinking, this thing was branded within an inch of its life. Like,
right.
Like, I don't trust this. I do not trust this branding. But people, that's what they'd expected and that's what they wanted. And clearly, what do I know? You know, we underbrand, and so maybe they're doing the right thing. But branding... I just don't know how apart it is from selling. And that's certainly what this Liquid Death thing says. It's like, you want to sell people stuff. I love it when he says, people don't make choices according to reason or rationality.
No.
98% of choice making of consumer products is irrational. It's emotional.
Yes.
And certainly
that's
true.
What the heart loves, the will chooses, and the mind justifies.
Sarah, anything else to say? Remember when we did that branding episode? That was a fun one, where the new type of branding was to de-brand.
Bland.
Yeah. Now all I can think about is the specialty bras made for women with small boobs. And I kept getting these ads. I kept getting these ads on Instagram that were like, are you a member of the Little Bitty Titty Committee? And I was like, how do you know? Who told you? Yeah, I mean, it's like, but also everybody makes small bras. You know what I mean?
RJ can't
it's like,
breathe.
How new is this technology? Okay. There's not a lot we need from a bra. So I don't know. I think the interesting question is, what is it about this that makes us feel like we are attracted to it? And I think it just makes us feel known. And we're not really in that exchange, right? We're not actually known. Like, you know,
it's just virtue
the company
signaling.
doesn't. But I do think there's a sense of like being known in a specific way, right? Mm-hmm. That we make these choices, but we're not actually being known by these companies. We're just, I don't know. I feel like there's something deeper in us that, there's some virtue signaling, but I buy beauty products for the same reason people buy Liquid Death, and nobody sees that, right? They sit in my bathroom. So there's something about feeling known. Mm.
It's about identity. It's aspirational. It's who we want to be, who we want others to think we are, the crowd we want to be part of, you know? Yeah. I mean, pretty soon there's going to be a massive backlash against Liquid Death. You know, kind of like, I mean, people still drink LaCroix, but it's not like the thing anymore, really.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So
I feel like I'm the last person in America who still drinks tap water. Flat. I like it. I think it's good.
Like room temperature?
I'm not going to apologize. No, sometimes I'll do ice. You know, I'll get really fancy.
If he's feeling real crazy. Yeah, I mean, if he's had a long day, he's like, you know what?
Just comes home after a long day and
three.
I'm
going to
have ice water.
Hits the spot.
Not four.
Well, yeah, the one thing I will say for Liquid Death, and you know, my kids just think it's cool. You know, it has been marketed to them, and like they think the mango chainsaw sounds pretty cool. You know, and
I just thought it was trying so hard.
Well, it just sounds like Axe body spray.
Some of it, I would say, as you mentioned with like the State Farm stuff, what I appreciate about it is when it's funny. Like I do sometimes it makes me laugh, and you know, advertisements don't have to, they can be super serious. Like we just watched a Subaru ad where like it's about you know, your kid's almost dying in the car, and it's like, oh, I don't know if I can handle these.
I hate that.
Or someone like some kid leaving for college, and it's like, I feel more manipulated in that sense than I do when I'm watching something that's just trying to be cheeky and kind of funny. Let's go to the next thing. This is from Sam Bush on Mockingbird, The Case Against the Instant Classic. So what he writes, he says, what do Barbie, Taylor Swift's Eras Tour, and this year's Super Bowl all have in common? They have all been given the most coveted accolade of our age, the instant classic. Whether it's a fashion item, a political speech, or a hit song, the term implies that as soon as a thing came into the world, it achieved immortal status and will be remembered forever. Whenever we experience a cultural phenomenon like this, we often feel like we're a living part of history. We look forward to telling our children that we personally witnessed such a momentous occasion. There's just one catch. The instant classic does not actually exist. The truth is, it takes time for genuine genius to be seen for what it is. Consider some of the greatest artists who are ahead of their time. Obviously, Vincent van Gogh only sold one painting before he died. The Gettysburg Address received mixed reviews from the newspapers of its day. Citizen Kane was a flop at the box office and was snubbed for Best Picture. Art, as it turns out, is less like a flash in the pan and more like a seed buried in the ground. Woo-hoo. Sam getting biblical. And yet, we think we know right now what will stand the test of time, and so we cheer on the next GOAT with the hope that their legends will live forever. In sports, it's always who's the GOAT conversation. This is how this plays out.
Do you know GOAT stands for, sir?
Greatest of all time.
Oh,
I know
nice.
That.
Okay,
yeah.
I just wanted to check.
I know those. It's just you throw a big word at me, and I'm like, okay, one of us went to Mississippi Public School, and the rest of us, yeah.
Say it six times in a row. To add to the old familiar trope, you don't know what you've got till it's gone. And we really don't know what is truly good until it's long gone, Sam writes. So it goes with Christianity, the phenomenon that nobody saw coming. It's no secret that the church underwent a long gestation period before coming into full bloom. So much so that a recent article can argue that the Jesus of the Gospels never existed because no contemporary writers make any reference to him. Gail Evans writes, you'd think that a cult leader who drew crowds, inspired devoted followers, and was executed on the order of a Roman governor would leave some indentation in contemporary records. Compared with Socrates, for example, whose pupils and contemporary critics wrote books and plays about him, Jesus hardly gets any mention from anyone within his actual lifetime. That's not 100% true, but it's in other words, Evans wants Jesus to be an instant classic. After all, how important could the Son of God have been if he didn't even make the headlines while he was alive? Truly, if Jesus was at all the figure the Gospels claim him to be, people would have known it from the start, right? But the life and death of Jesus is much more like a seed sown in the ground rather than a flash in the pan we might expect. He hardly made a splash during his own lifetime, at least one big enough to cause a respectable revolution. He was an ordinary Jew, the son of a common carpenter. And though his ministry started with throngs of adoring crowds, with every step he took toward Jerusalem, those crowds slowly dwindled until he was left hanging on a cross all alone. It wasn't until well after Jesus' resurrection that anyone had an inkling about how momentous an event they were experiencing actually was. Or take the scriptures. The Gospel of Thomas could have made a big splash at first, but its star would fade as quickly as it came. The Gospel of Mark might be beloved today, but nearly no one in the early church bothered to cite it. The wheat and the weeds grow side by side for much longer than we'd like to believe before God does the sifting. The same is true for us, of course. As we try to discern what God is doing in our own lives, we assume that certain things are instant classics, graduations, promotions, and new cars. And yet the things that often make the most impact in our lives happen undercover, things that look like utter failure. The accident that stripped you of the illusion of control, the friend who came to visit you in jail. The present is overflowing with significance, but its meaning can only be seen from the vantage point of eternity. Indeed, only God knows what is truly classic and what is not. We may not know in that very instant, but we can trust that it will be revealed in due time. What a great article. I mean, Sam is on a streak these days. Much as I dislike him personally, I have to admit he's got something to say here.
He's so mean.
He's just such a jerk.
I keep thinking about, not to read a whole other thing, but I keep thinking about this Garrison Keillor quote that I sent to you guys this morning. It overlaps with this. Okay, so this is Garrison Keillor's latest Substack. I love Garrison Keillor. He influenced me more in my preaching than anybody else ever has. His modern day version of himself is that when he writes something, he always feels the need to make a political statement somewhere in it. And I hate that, because it kind of can take away from the beauty of what he's really saying. So if you go to the Substack, we'll link to the Substack. It does get political at the end. Don't read that, because if you disagree with him, you're going to get mad. And if you agree with him, you're going to get self-righteous. So just read the first part. That's my advice. Okay.
Amen.
So he says, when I've organized my stuff, I plan to write one more novel, and that's absolutely the last, no matter how many six-figure advances publishers thrust at me. And then I'll start writing, and this is a book title, Screwing Up is a Good Start, which puts forth my philosophy that disaster draws us together and success isolates us. Look at me. I was a very good boy who gave my parents no worries, and as a result, we were strangers to each other. Now, I wish I'd gotten a girl pregnant in 12th grade, lived with her in the basement, got into the scotch, sniffed the white powder, spent some time in lockup, and my folks would have adored the child, coaxed me back to responsible adulthood. My wife would have written a brilliant first novel based on the crap I put her through, and we'd be sitting pretty today. Instead, I walked a straight line, followed the rules, ascended the slippery slope, and now I sit here alone. Nobody calls. Nobody texts.
Oh, wow.
There's something for me. I mean, I think of Garrison Keillor as somebody we think of as classic, right? Mm-hmm. And there's something so beautiful to me about having a person that sort of maybe meets that category, like speaking back to us, it was all for naught. I don't know. There's something really like beautiful and or speaking back to us like it was the worst things that drew us together in such a beautiful way. I don't want to sort of veer too far away from what Sam said, because, you know, a lot of the things that, especially right now, that we say, oh, that was an instant classic, are actually the things that are super divisive, because our culture is so divisive right now, right? That when we say, oh, it's an instant classic, it's like, I just wonder how much of our motives are to get at each other when we say things like that.
Yeah.
I don't know if any of that made any sense, but I just love that quote.
This is more important than what you think is important, is kind of a translation of what it can sometimes mean.
Right.
That's such a powerful quote, Sarah, and it just makes me wonder, and I do think it's probably true, that places, cultures, communities that are successful are lonelier, and cultures that are, you know, less successful might be less lonely.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It's very easy for me to say, from my kind of like upper middle class white whatever, you know, from kind of a culture of success. But I also feel like there's a tremendous amount of loneliness and despair and depression and anxiety in the culture that I inhabit and haven't inhabited pretty much my whole life. And I don't know. And I don't know. I have no authority to speak on cultures that are not steeped in like performance and success, because I've never lived in that place. But I kind of have a hunch a little bit.
I grew up in a culture like that. And let me tell you, there are days when I see, you know, people from back home. I mean, I think about when my parents died and like my high school class raised $900. And literally they raised it, you guys, because they didn't think we'd be able to afford the funeral, because a lot of them live in situations where they would not have been able to afford the funerals, right? Wow. And they passed the hat around and put money in it in such a beautiful communal way. And these are people I have not talked to since high school graduation. And I was kind of a B-word too when I was in person there. But most of them all still live in that community, and they all still take care of each other, and they have for their whole lifetimes. And no one would ever look at the Flowood area of Mississippi and think, well, it's a really successful area. You know, like no one's thinking that. So I totally agree with you. I mean, I think there's beauty there.
And I guess a couple of the stories I think about, and then I'm going to make a more meta point and see what you guys think. You know, a friend of mine who served in India for a year with International Justice Mission as a lawyer, and he said, he came back and he said, I saw some of the most awful things I've ever seen, but I also experienced like a depth of community and love and interconnectedness unlike anything I've ever seen. And, and you know, and then, you know, our common friend, oh my gosh, Daphne Butler's husband, Lawrence, you know, who's worked in Central America and I don't know. He invited a student from Central America to come to do Thanksgiving with him once with their family up in New England. And after Thanksgiving, he's like, well, what did you think? Or it came to New York City. He's like, what do you think about New York? He's like, well, everyone seems really lonely. And what did you think about Thanksgiving? He's like, well, it was great, but that's like every day at my house. you know, like that's like, this is a big, this is once a year for you. This is every day at my house.
Yeah.
So the more meta point was, our Wednesday nights, we've been having people in our church who have served in other contexts around the world come and talk about their experience in Kenya, in Southeast Asia, in Pakistan, in Madagascar, whatever. We had a guy this past week come talk to us about the church in Latin America. And he said one of the ironies of the of Latin America in general is that it's probably the most Christian culture in the world. Right, like pretty much everyone in Latin America goes to church, whether it's Catholic or more recently Pentecostal or whatever. Yeah. And yet it's also a culture of like tremendous inequity, poverty, corruption, like all that sort of stuff. And like, why is that? Why is it the most Christian culture is also the most exploitative or something like that? Or there's so much suffering. And I'm like, is that an oxymoron? Is that a conflict or not? You know, because you think about God's chosen people tend not to have a very easy time of it. You know, like, is there, I don't want to say, I don't know. I don't know what to say about that. Like, if it's true that cultures of success are lonely and sort of miserable and cultures that are not as obsessed with success or performance are a little bit more interconnected. And I don't know. Do you see what I'm saying?
Like, I love what you're saying too, because
it feels like a very dangerous thing to say. I don't really want to say it.
But there's something really beautiful about like we are spending all this time and energy in our current culture talking about what an instant classic is, but what an instant classic to God is.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
is so different.
So different,
right?
100%.
And that's the thrust of what Sam's trying to say. Yeah. Like this, I trust the Jesus, you know, the accounts more.
Yeah.
Because they didn't feed necessarily into everyone's immediate.
They're not well branded.
Yeah, they're not well branded. They're certainly not well branded. I guess what I'm saying is if we're entering into Holy Week, if the Holy Week narrative, if the Passion played into the instant classic narrative, I would be a little concerned because that is the glory story. That is the R.J. Heyman story. You know, that's the I kid, but it is like there's got to be a little bit of obscurity to it. The whole thing is got bathed in obscurity, and that's why it's so part of why it's so beautiful.
Yeah.
And anyway, and Jesus, and of course Jesus was mentioned by contemporary, you know, historians and stuff like that. Just not in the same he wasn't a celebrity in the way that we conceive of that. And thank God for that. You know, it doesn't appear that God really works through celebrity. I'm just going to say it out right now. Like, possibly every once in a while, I mean, Dolly Parton, I guess, but most of the time, God seems to be working through ordinariness and defeat and failure and the Nazareth.
AKA the church.
AKA the church. Oh, gosh.
No, but like, I know we've talked a lot about this, but like, that's funny, but also that is much more authentic branding and much more compelling branding, right, for the church than sort of like, we're going to call ourselves a different name and get a new logo, right? Like, I mean, I always think of Nadia Boltz-Weber's church plant, right, the House for Saints and Sinners, but like, what would it look like if it was just like, Church for losers, you know, like what is that?
Loser church.
Loser church.
No, that's harder to brand.
It is.
Well, let's go into the second to last article here that has more to do with stuff that is not glamorous, and it has to do with Alzheimer's. Mm. This is from Jen Pollock Michel, who is sort of a well-known writer who wrote this for Mockingbird, called The Long Lent of Alzheimer's. Mm. She writes this: "The Alzheimer's journey is a perpetual Lent. Each day is scarred with the black ash of mortality. Dust to dust, ashes to ashes. I need no reminding of death when my mother forgets the name of my father, dead since 1993. I need no reminding when at 5 a.m. she calls me again to ask the time and the date. Remember that you have a clock by the microwave, I say groggily. My mother's life is an unraveling, an unspooling, an unwriting. Memory spills and scatters like loose change. She will die, and this is obvious in the most banal ways. At church, when we pass the peace, my mother can't answer the polite questions of a stranger. Where do I live, Jen? She turns to ask me. If I'm being most truthful, I can still feel the slight embarrassment of her decline, the blank looks, the social awkwardness, the dragging hem of the pants that I must now remind her to wash. I do not love as God loves. And then there is, for another example, a picture my mother routinely takes out of her purse as we sit together in the doctor's offices. Who is this? My mother asks, pointing to the 20-something man at my left shoulder. I date the picture to 1995 in my mind, before the young man's psychic break. That's my brother, I say. David, I add. She looks long at the picture. Then, as if memory has struck a distant chord, it sends back a faint sound. He committed suicide, didn't he? She looks at me plaintively, and I nod, knowing what's next. That's so sad, she says. It is sad, I say, as I've said many, many times before. According to Saint Benedict, in his 6th century rule, the life of a monk ought to be a continuous Lent. It's to say that Lent is not the only time in which to persevere. It is to suggest that lament might be a more than seasonal heart cry. This is how I've begun to see the striking similarities between the long dying of Lent and the long dying of Alzheimer's. Both, as seasons of suffering and grief, must simply be endured until Easter. Lent intends for us to feel the crippling of our hands, the corruption of our hearts, the ways in which only God, by his power and love, can make our lame legs walk and our blind eyes see. The gospel does not improve us. It saves us, rescues us, and affects a wholeness that could never be possible apart from the dramatic acts of salvation played out in the death, resurrection, and ascension of Jesus Christ. In much the same way, my mother cannot will herself back to physical health. Neither can I, by dint of my own power, hold back the terrible suffering yet ahead. No, like all penitents, we wait on God to act. It is God who will bring her to the swinging door of time. She will leave this world and enter the eternity God has prepared for those who love him and are called according to his purpose. Yes, God's working a great good for my mother, as she'll see Easter before I do. Mm. Yet one thing I know, if the Lenten journey of Alzheimer is darkness, the sun will rise. Morning always comes."
Who is this?
Jen Pollock Michel. She's written a bunch of books. She's
this is fabulous.
A speaker. She writes that she hasn't really written about this journey that's clearly consuming her whole life. That they her family moved to be closer to her mother, and it's a very powerful. You know, for once, sometimes we try to minimize the Lent talk on Mockingbird, partly because it can feel fashionable and just a little hackneyed. This is a Lenten observation I can get behind, and I want to sort of trumpet from the rooftops. It's just so powerful, because what she the connection she makes, and the much of the point of the article is that all of us are living in Lent all the time. It was Fitz Allison who said every day is Good Friday around here, and for me it's an important sort of it was a powerful and stirring thing to read as we approach Holy Week. The whole story that's about to unfold is God not denying or turning away from the darkness. Every chance Jesus gets, he does not leave. He does not bail. He actually goes further into the depths. He goes into hell, you know, as we say. But I don't know. Alzheimer's is one of these things that I've found as I've gotten older. More people than I ever realized deal with infertility, and more people deal with dementia or Alzheimer than I ever realized. Like, this is just hidden from when you're an adolescent or in your 20s. these are very real concerns for a lot of people. And especially if you're in church work and you're dealing with an older generation, you and those who are about to take care of an older generation, I think if we're not talking about this, we're not talking about people's lives. So, I mean, RJ, you've got because you're in Florida, you've got, I know, a lot of older folks down there. Sarah, I know you've had plenty of experience with this as well. I'd just love to hear what this brings up for you.
It reminds me, who said, I think there's an article we read here once where or maybe it's a movie or somewhere, someone said, you know, maybe what it means to be human is to be a little bit sad all the time. Just a little bit sad all the time. And there's something to that. Made me think of a couple things. I said this before, but it always strikes me when I'm with someone who is older and losing their ability to care for themselves, losing their ability to think clearly, losing their mobility, you know, just losing all these things, these abilities that they had. How the words that Jesus says, you know, no one can enter the kingdom of heaven unless they enter it like a little child, start to take on a whole new meaning. You know, how we're born in dependency and we die in dependency. And we have this sort of, you know, we talked about being sort of disabled, right? That we're our adulthood is being temporarily abled, but we're born less abled and often die less abled. But I think there's some beauty to that too, because I know there's a few people in my church that come to mind who are dealing with some cognitive decline and their spouses are taking care of them. And to see the way that our church embraces them and loves them and they can come to church and feel comfortable and you know, even though they may not be able to read as well as they could or speak as well as they could, it's a space where they're able to be loved. And then I'll share one more experience I had recently, which is really amazing. It's a parishioner of mine I know whose mother was not doing well. And I called her, she didn't pick up, I texted her. And she said, well, yeah, we put mom in hospice and, you know, it's not going well. And I said, well, let me know when I can come over. She said, well, you probably should come soon. You know, her oxygen level is dropping. So I went over there, we said some prayers, and then her mom passed away like 10, 15 minutes later, like right in front of us.
Wow.
It was kind of amazing. And she said to me that the daughter did, she said it'd been the most amazing day. She said, my mom woke up this morning and looked at me and said, today's the day, like I'm leaving today. And she said, my mother, like we've always been very close, but she's not always been the easiest person. But today, she was more gracious and open-hearted and generous than I've ever seen her. And we called everyone we needed to call and said everything we needed to say. And then honestly, she said, RJ, I think she was just waiting for you to show up and say these prayers so that she could leave. And what we do believe as Christians, I think it's not super clear what happens when some things are clear about heaven and all that sort of stuff. But one thing seems clear is that when we get to heaven, we are going to be the best possible version of ourselves. We'll be who we are, but all depression, all anxiety, all fear, all pain, all resentment, all sin will be chased away. And it was like this day I spent, or this day that she had spent with her mother, it's like her mother was like on her way there, like in between who she was and the best version of herself.
Yeah.
Which is so tremendously hopeful, you know. I don't know. So that was my long-winded thoughts.
I think about, and I've had this experience a lot lately and like everything else in my life, I'm always like, is this perimenopause? But I'll have these moments where I'm just trying to like get household stuff done. I'm trying to get dinner on the table. I'm trying to, you know, whatever, get clothes picked up, get laundry done.
And I'll be classic.
Struck. Yeah, exactly. And I'll be struck with initially a rage and I'll be like, oh my God, what is that? And I'll kind of stand there and then it'll be like really sad. Like I'll almost start to cry. And I'll be like, what the hell is going on with me? And yeah, part of it is probably hormonal, but I'll be like, why am I so sad? And then I'll be like, oh, right, because something terrible happened. And I don't know if I'll do that the rest of my life, you know? And I know a lot of people probably don't want to hear that, like, our whole lives are a Lent, but like, I find that really comforting. I found it very comforting that the writer said lament is more than a seasonal heart cry.
Oof.
Because I forget the loss. And then when it comes roaring back at me in these moments, it's like, oh yeah, that's here too. You know, with all the tasks you have to do, with all the love you have for the people who are in front of you, like that's here too. And also there's something, you know, grief is so intrinsically linked to love. We wouldn't grieve if we didn't love, right? Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I remember doing a, we were doing those, speaking of COVID, through Mockingbird, we were doing those like devotionals. Do you remember? Mm-hmm. And you would record them at your house and then Mockingbird would put them up. And the one I had done right before my parents died, I said that Dolly Parton quote, grief is love with no place to go. And it just, I wouldn't trade those moments of like weird blind rage and deep sadness, because they also remind me of how profound the love is there. Alzheimer's is the worst. Mm. And it's horrible for children. I mean, I have friends who are going through this. It's horrible for the children of the people who have it, because it is also genetic. And so it's like, you're not just taking care of your parent. You're not just thinking about their death. You're thinking, is this going to happen to me? Is this going to be how I die? You know, it's just, it's a monster of a disease.
Yeah. Another shout out to Mary Cale's wonderful book, Dementia and the Church, which came out last year. I think it's a wonderful helping hand to people. I mean, we have a group here that meets these, they're all ladies sort of in their 70s or so, and they're all basically taking care of men who are cognitively impaired or declining, and including, I mean, she would say it publicly, including Mary Lou Thomas, who's one of my colleagues and will be speaking at Mockingbird this year, sort of partly about this subject and aging. But I consider them to sort of be the holiest women at the church.
100%.
I want to kind of just follow them to their lunch and sort of just see what it is like to be that drawn out of yourself and to be displaying that much sacrificial love. I've seen husbands do it. There's an older man who's had to do it for his wife. It goes both ways. It's a very, very beautiful thing. And I wish we could talk about it a bit more, but I think in the church, we do need to talk about this.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, it's the actual instant classics of life are those ladies, I think. And the the things that last, the posts, for example, on Mockingbird, which seem to get clicks year after year after year, are always about, you know, Ben Madison talking about infertility.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And sometimes it's grace in destruction, and there's always a redemptive side because we're Christians. But I would say that, like, I think about this in terms of my own writing. Like, the book Seculosity that I wrote felt pretty timely, and it got traction for that reason. Yet the book about limitation and suffering and sin, Low Anthropology, I personally think it's, I feel it's got more staying power. I think it's because it's about this stuff, and it's not as sexy, it's not as glamorous, but it won't be eclipsed when there's a new replacement religion that takes over, you know. And I think that if, especially when we're talking about branding in the church, you know, brand your church around the stuff that where real holiness and, you know, life is to be found, which is the Lenten experience of life. And it is. That's where we bed down, right, Sarah?
It's what brings people together.
I just, as you were talking about those women at your church, I thought of something my friend, our friend, Jane Grizzle said. Jane and I are both raising daughters who are navigating early middle school, which is a nightmare. And sort of having conversations with them about what it means to be popular and all this stuff. And she texted me this brilliant thing. She said, you know, I don't want my girls to think they have to peak in middle school. I don't want to peak in middle school. I want to peak when I'm like a 70-year-old church lady. And I think that's a good word.
That's,
you know,
a great word.
Yeah.
Well, let's end with a very sort of direct theological piece that ties into the Holy Week and into Good Friday and into the resurrection and what we're actually doing when we come together on Easter. And this is by Emil Brunner. the Swiss theologian who sparred with Karl Barth, and it was published on, it's an excerpt, so he's long dead, but it was published on Plow very recently. It's called God's Forgiveness is Costly. This is what he writes. He says, it is quite ethical to say man ought to forgive, but it is in the highest degree non-ethical to say God also ought to forgive. There is no more impious saying, but it only expresses the thought of all who have been influenced by the Enlightenment. Of course God will do it. How could he do otherwise since he is so kindly? As soon as anyone regards the forgiveness of God as a matter of course, he is as audacious as Voltaire. That's an insult in the French-speaking world.
For all this, you Southern kids out there.
This impiety is not modified if we say God forgives if we repent, for this simply amounts to a denial of guilt, and it also amounts to a denial of sin, for the sinner can never repent in proportion to his sin. There are no human conditions in which we have the right to expect that God will forgive us as a matter of course. So it is not a logical necessity to God to forgive. He can forgive or not forgive. Indeed, it is of the very nature of God to possess this freedom, this mysterious will which men cannot understand. Thus, forgiveness can only be revealed to us as something which actually happens, as a fact, as an amazing assurance of forgiveness from God himself. He goes on, he says, God meets us at the point where we become real. That is, where we stand before him naked, stripped of all illusions and coverings or masks, with nothing to shield us from his gaze. This only happens where our inmost soul is exposed, where, in the presence of God, we have no excuses to offer, nothing to say. Our humiliation is complete when we perceive that in ourselves we cannot possibly reach God. This illusion, and the illusion of religious people, is only finally destroyed by the mediator of the atonement. Everything which religious thought has invented in order to mediate between God and man is more noble, is less humiliating for us than the conviction that this atonement is necessary. The more realistic we are, the more knowledge of guilt we possess. The more real man becomes, the more he acknowledges himself to be guilty. The more clearly we see that fellowship with God is not something which can be taken completely for granted, the more we see that it is costly, and the cost is not paid by man. We're getting into time where we talk about the atonement, and this is a dirty word in certain circles. It's overused in others, but I thought his injunction to just assume that God will forgive us no matter what, and that because when forgiveness does not come naturally to any of us, why would it come so naturally to the one who created us? But in fact, there is a cost. There is something that there is an obstacle almost. And this also this description that the more real or honest or transparent we become, the more aware we are of how short we fall, of our guilt, of our need. And this is the great lesson and the great revelation that God doesn't have to forgive, but God does forgive. That is the atonement, which we see, you know, in the snake that's lifted up.
I don't like this. Sorry. I'm just like, I don't like this.
Quick preaching, Dave. Tell me.
I think very few people take God's forgiveness for granted. I don't think that's a problem. I think people, anybody you talk to who doesn't go to church is always like, oh man, if I walked into a church right now, I'd get struck by lightning.
Yes.
I don't think
I'd be welcome at church, someone said to me recently.
This is bullshit. I don't like this at all. I mean, like, okay. Atonement aside, which is, you know, a beautiful thing we can talk about, like, I mean, I rest in the fact that I take God's forgiveness for granted. Like, I find great comfort in that. And I do, and I have to remind myself that God's forgiveness is promised, right? Like, he didn't come into the world to condemn the world, but to save the world. And like, that's very fundamental for my survival. So yeah, I don't love this guy, but maybe
I think he was writing in response to people who were saying that, of course, God will forgive because God is forgiveness. And you're saying is that no one assumes that God is forgiveness.
No, I mean, not now. Maybe they did when this guy was writing.
And there's only one religion that says that. Yeah. You know, God is forgiveness, but only the God is revealed in and through Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Well, that's clearly what I hear is he's saying, we know God is forgiveness, not because we want God to be forgiving, but because of Jesus' death on the cross.
Absolutely. I'd still fight this guy in the street, but yeah.
No, a lively episode on The Mockingcast.
I mean, I would go back to is, you know, we don't preach the atonement enough in the church. We don't talk about the atonement a lot, especially in mainline Christianity, especially in the Episcopal Church. I mean, I've told this story before about when I was in seminary and a really sweet priest was like, oh, I'll walk you through like basically how to do the Eucharist. That was not a thing I was taught at Yale. And I don't want my husband to teach me it because that's not sexy. And he said, it's not. Yeah, yeah. Not for us. Maybe for some other weirdos. But this really sweet priest who'd been ordained for a long time, like literally was taking me through some of the words of our Eucharistic prayer, which has a certain amount of atonement theology in it. And he said, you know, I just skip the parts that have a lot of atonement theology.
Oh my gosh.
And so, I mean, there is a real avoidance of it. And I do think when we do not talk about the atonement, I think that's when we run the risk. And I think that may be why people don't believe in forgiveness, because it's like when we don't talk about the atonement, we don't understand forgiveness. And when we don't understand forgiveness, we can't believe it for ourselves.
Yeah, I hear that's exactly what I think is going on. I mean, maybe not in the passage, but I think that the atonement is the how and sometimes the why of forgiveness.
Yes.
When I'm in a dark place, I don't care about the how and the why. I just need to know that I'm forgiven. And that is very true. But it can sometimes – but without the how do I know that God is forgiving? Yeah. It certainly doesn't seem that through nature, through the tsunamis that I experience.
I certainly don't feel that way.
And other people aren't naturally forgiving. It doesn't come naturally. So how do I know? Is it just because you're saying so? Well, no, here's the fact of it. And that is...
How do I know if he really
loves me?
There was a person... So there's a woman... Another woman who... No.
This is great.
Who came to church recently, and she wanted to talk to me afterwards. And she said, you know, RJ, I haven't really been a churchgoer, but I've come the past 3 weeks, and this Sunday, for I don't even know why, I just kind of cried all through the service.
Yep.
But she said, you know, you talk about these people who have failed and who have sinned and who are suffering, and I don't feel that for myself. Like, I feel like I'm basically a good person, and this whole sin thing isn't really real, and things are basically going okay. So, like, what does this mean for me?
Why was she crying? Yeah.
Well, yeah, but she's also crying, and she doesn't really know why. And she's like, it's not a bad cry. It's a good cry. So we talked a little bit about what sin means, but then she proceeded to tell me about a family member of hers who has just like completely torn their family apart, and she wanted prayer for that, you know. And sometimes I do have that thought, like, am I speaking to where people are? Are most people just kind of living their life, thinking they're basically a good person, they're not suffering, they're gliding through? And I'm like, that might be a subset, but then when I think about everyone I know, they're all going through something.
Yeah,
they're almost without exception going through something. And if they're not right now, they will be in like a week. Like, there was another person who said to me once, RJ, you know, you talk about all this sin and Jesus and death, but we just don't talk much about the social issues of the day or politics. And I sort of said to them, well, you're right. Like, I know that's real, but it's not really all that real. It feels very real because it's all you watch on the news. But what I think is more real is like your marriage, your children, your whatever it is. And then, oh God, I hate to say this. Oh.
Come on, RJ. Come on.
Then this particular person who I love her so much, her adult daughter, like, really unexpectedly died, you know? It's awful, and it's been a little while, and there's, you know, there's been some grieving and mourning and healing. But I guess I don't want to say that proves the point, but it does a little bit, right? Like, we may have moments where we feel like we sort of got our act together or like everything is fine, but they're few, they're fleeting. And it feels more like when someone doesn't think a sin is an issue for them, it feels more like denial then it feels like truth, right? It's like, really?
I actually don't think there's anybody who has it together. I just don't believe that. Even in the most basic way, it's like, you know, I can't keep my freaking house clean to save my life. Like, I can't, like, you know, I have to say, like, today I wanted to cancel the podcast because I'm driving to go speak at Calvary Episcopal in Memphis. It's going to be too late for you to go if you hear this, but, you know, I've got a 3-hour drive ahead of me. I got a kid that's homesick. I haven't packed yet. I'm in my bathrobe and I'm doing a Q&A tonight. It's crazy.
Well, the bathrobe thing is not,
I don't appreciate it at all.
I don't know about that.
That's kind of regular.
Everything else, yes.
But like, I was like, this morning, I was like, kind of freaking out. And I was like, you know what? God's going to take care of this.
Totally.
Like, if God has called you into this day, yes, God's going to carry you through this day.
Yes.
And what I didn't have is a moment where I thought, oh, you should have thought that earlier. And I used to. I used to think like, oh, you should have thought that earlier. You should have.
Where's your faith, Sarah?
Right. Exactly. Like, don't you know? And and so for me, there's like no more beautiful version of God than the God that I'm able to take His grace and generosity and forgiveness for granted.
Mm. Well, there you go. I mean, that's a good word, I think. It's also a good word to say that, you know, Lent is every day. And if you think people are walking into your church that they're so comfortable and they need to be afflicted by your preaching, the truth is everyone's afflicted. And they may not be completely aware of that or willing to fess up to it, but we have to preach as though someone's daughter just died. You cannot risk preaching. I just would say this is a hill I would die on. You cannot risk the one Sunday preaching about the headlines at the expense of addressing the person whose daughter just died. Like, you have to assume that someone in the crowd needs to hear about sin, about darkness, but also about the resurrection and about forgiveness. And, you know, they need to be told they can take it for granted. This is why Holy Week is so wonderful. And I wish why we do talk about it so much. RJ.
And also, you know, tragedy leads to intimacy and relationship. Yeah. It's just true. And it's not because God is a dick.
Yeah.
It's just there's something true about it, you know?
Yeah.
Like, the success leads to isolation, or obsession with success leads to isolation, and tragedy and failure and heartbreak lead to intimacy and relationship. Mm. And it sucks. I hate it.
It does.
But it's just true.
But it's just true.
It's
the thing Garrison Keillor said, right? He said, disaster draws us together and success isolates us.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Like, I've never felt more connected to a group of people than when the flutist in the band on our tour dropped dead of an aneurysm in the shower, which is the most awful thing. But suddenly 60 people came together. This was in high school. And like, it was amazing, the community we had. Now, at a high cost, it came at a cost.
Right.
You know? But it's just true.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what else is true is that usually our podcast gets the E for explicit because of something Sarah said. But this week, it's definitely because
it's definitely
of
RJ. Well, and I'll be fired. I'll be fired in a couple weeks.
Oh my!
So you'll be able to tell us how
my wife
great
is not going to be happy with this.
Yeah.
We shall see. Thank you guys both, and I do wish everyone out there. I hope it goes well. I hope that you're able to endure till Easter, and I hope that you have a joyful Easter, like those elephants sliding in the mud.
Absolutely,
that's my new
have
my
an
new...
elephant mud sliding kind of Easter.
We're gonna slip and slide on the front lawn.
All right, bye, you guys.
Bye. Bye.
Thank you for listening. Remember, you can find us on the web at www.embird.com. And we'd always love to hear from you at info@embird.com. Audio production for The Mockingcast is provided by TJ Hester. And if you like what you've heard, please drop over to iTunes and leave us a rating or review. Until next time.